This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
Of course, if you're kind and you're generous, you're accepting and patient. And when it comes to discovering who you are, you'll need a lot of that.
Have you ever wondered how to empower the dreamers in your life to be the fullest expressions of themselves, to take audacious leaps, to connect with their passion in a meaningful way to serve the world? In this episode, you'll learn the four questions you can ask to connect students with their purpose, the top two ways anyone can generate new and creative ideas, and the most important question everyone should be asking themselves in order to live a life of joyful intention. I am thrilled about this remarkable interview with the best-selling, award-winning author, Peter H. Reynolds. Join us as we deep dive into creativity, dreaming, and joyful expression. Creativity champion Peter H. Reynolds is a New York Times best-selling author and illustrator, published in over 25 languages. Peter's book, The Dot, Ish, The Word Collector, and Happy Dreamer, among many others, inspire children and grown-up children with his messages about authentic learning, creativity, bravery, empathy, and courageous self-expression. Peter also illustrated the best-selling books I Am Yoga, I Am Peace, and I Am Human, which was recently a number one New York Times best-selling picture book, and The Water Princess with Susan Verde, as well as the Judy Moody series by Megan McDonald. Peter lives in Boston area, where he founded The Blue Bunny, a family-owned and operated children's book, toy, and creativity store. Peter and his twin brother Paul launched the Reynolds Center for Teaching, Learning, and Creativity. You can find Peter on Twitter at Peter H. Reynolds and by visiting his website, peterhreynolds.com.
Hello, this is Peter Reynolds.
Hello, Peter Reynolds. This is Morgan Michael. What a thrill to be speaking to you.
Oh, you're so kind.
So you've talked about the fact that you have vision, that you can see things that don't exist maybe in a really tangible way. How has that served your creativity? And what would you say to a child who sees the world in terms of possibility?
My brain has been percolating with images and color and characters and story for really as long as I can remember. Yeah, when I was a very young child, if someone was reading to me, I could make these little movies in my head. And as I began to read myself, even if there weren't images to go along with the text, I would make my own little film. And those little films really helped me understand what I was learning, understand the world. And then I realized, like, oh, I could actually do a little visual note-taking and transcribe what was going on in my head onto paper. And of course, those became, you know, stories and characters and drawings. And that eventually led to making books. And I've made quite a few, and I still have loads and loads more because this brain of mine just does not stop popping the popcorn.
I love that. And what would you say in terms of how a teacher, because this is primarily a podcast for educators who are sort of at the forefront, almost like gatekeepers to the way that kids see themselves in many respects. And so what is it that a teacher is able to do to support and encourage these children who may not always present in a quote unquote typical manner within the classroom in this more conformity oriented industrial model of education? How do we encourage those students to tap into that creative ability, that ability to see, again, that possibility of what doesn't yet exist, but what could be within right. their head? Mm-hmm.
Educators have such an amazing job on their hands, and they do such amazing work. We certainly have not made it easy in public education, especially in the United States. to let teachers follow their own instincts. And, you know, we've put a lot of pressure on them to perform up to standards. To me, the best standard is that child reaching their full potential in their own creative way? And I think we don't trust teachers and we don't trust kids enough to say, you know, hey, it's going to be a little quirky, a little messy, a little zigzaggy, but with love, they will get there. They'll get to amazing places. So instead, we test kids at every turn. And of course, then teachers have to teach to the test. And there's a lot of focus on memorization and content rather than process and the big ideas. And of course, the biggest idea, you know, teachers, creative teachers know how to sneak this in. The biggest idea is asking kids a very powerful question. It's only three words. Who are you? Mm-hmm. It's an amazing question. It's powerful. And if you think about it, there aren't that many times in your 12-year journey that that question gets asked to you. So I encourage teachers and parents and anybody who's around kids and helping kids navigate to really focus on that. Who are you? Tell me who you are. Let's figure it out together. And the cool thing about great teaching is that sometimes teachers can actually see the potential in a child before the child sees it in themselves, which is what I had modeled in my book, The Dot. Vashti is very frustrated. She says she can't draw, but her teacher can actually, she can see it. She can see Vashti, the artist, and she realized that, you know, maybe with a bit of humor and some patience and some and a novel surprise that she springs on Vashti, that maybe she could unlock Vashti's self-perception of herself, not only as an artist, but as a brave young girl full of possibility. And also someone who can share that with others. My other suggestion is that if we're trying to inspire our kids to be creative, we really have to focus on ourselves as adults. Oftentimes, adults can be a bit clumsy and nervous around kids when it comes to their own creativity. And I've heard a lot of adults say, I can't draw. Mm-hmm. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. And those kids are looking up at their heroes, and I think they must be a little disappointed to hear, right, that mom and dad or their teacher says they can't draw. If we could model that, what does bravery look like? What does creativity look like? Be kind to ourselves. And you know, a lot of my books, in fact, I always tell kids there's one common thread in all of my books, and it's not art, it's not color, it's kindness. You'll always find a kind person in my books. And of course, there's kindness that we can show other people, but there's also kindness that we can show ourselves. Mm-hmm. And in my book, Ish, I was trying to help the main character to be kind to his own artwork. And it took an unlikely teacher. I like to point out that his teacher in who inspired him was his younger sister, mm-hmm. right? So teachers can come from unexpected places. And he learns how to be kinder to his own art, be more generous about mm-hmm. his own art. And of course, if you're kind and you're generous, you're accepting and patient. And when it comes to discovering who you are, you'll need a lot of that.
I love that. And I think, as you know, this podcast, Kindsight, is about doing that. And I think that's why your book speaks so much to me, but also to just about every teacher that I've connected with. You are such a gift in yourself in the way that you've been able to propel that message of self-compassion, but also of reaching back and helping people forward through your own compassionate action. And so, yeah, within The Dot, I see that story of courage with Vashti, who is courageous and brave and vulnerable enough to own the work that she does, and then being able to reach back and to encourage others to do the same. And I love how the trilogy, really, The Dot, Ish, Sky Color, how it kind of connects all of the stories through mm-hmm. almost like a pay it forward perspective. And I just love that idea of courageous kindness. And I guess on some level, I've always sort of wanted to ask you, have you ever felt like Ramon, where you felt like you wanted to put your paintbrush down?
Yeah, I've had my Ramon moments. You know, I mean, the longer you live, life throws you more challenges along the way. And I've been through some, you know, some tough situations where I've wanted to put my pencil down. And I've also, you know, in the creative arena, when it comes to writing, you know, creating stories, I have, you know, I've struggled. In fact, one story in particular, I had been kind of noodling it for 10 years. My agent, Holly McGee, who's one of the most lovely human beings on the planet, her agency's Pippin Properties in New York, and she's really one of the best agents on the planet. Well, she shared my story that I had drafted with several publishers that knew me, who had published my work. And for each one said, for their own reason, I think we'll pass. And this is fairly recently. And I share that story because I said to Holly, I said, do you know what? It's okay. Let's just skip this one. You know, we'll put this back in the shoebox. You know, I really feel fine having written it because it was from my heart. It was actually a story about me growing up as a child, struggling a bit, not having teachers understand my zigzaggy brain. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, it just feels good to have gotten it out. And I put it on paper, and maybe this story was just for me. Mm-hmm. And then Holly said to me, she said, Peter, wait a sec. You never told me this was your story. And I said, yeah. She said, can you write down exactly what you just said? So I wrote it down, just a simple one-page letter saying, you know, this is me. Yeah, I have a zigzaggy brain, and I took my own special floaty route through childhood and adulthood as well. And things turned out okay, you know? Yeah. And so she shared that letter with 10 publishers. She called me up 2 days later, and she said, we just got offers from every publisher for this book.
Wow.
And that was for a story that I was just about to put back in my shoebox. You know, Holly believed in me. She could see it from a different perspective, and she helped me frame it in a way that I hadn't thought to frame it. And so anyway, that book is Happy Dreamer.
Yes.
And that book is the first in the 3-book series that I did for Scholastic. When Scholastic read that book, they said, wow, this is, there are a lot of happy dreamers out there and they need this message. And for the kids, well, you know, everyone needs to be happier. And and I do encourage everyone to dream. The book is already well loved, and Barnes & Noble made it their summer pick this year and really helped spread the mission of the book.
I love it. And it's one of the books that I've read to my classes actually as well. And there's something so liberating about it, because I think what it does is it underscores the fact that we are all different in the way that we approach learning and life. And sometimes, again, back to this model of education, there can often be this perception that there's only one way to learn or to approach the world. And so what you've done is you've enabled kids to identify with a number of different approaches. And so when it comes to dreaming, you sort of touched on this earlier, we allow and almost expect it from children. But when it comes to adults, there's sort of this negative connotation that accompanies this concept of being a dreamer. And I think you've said before in a previous interview, I wish you could hear inside my head. So what does it mean to be a dreamer? And what unique gifts does a dreamer bring to the world?
I love the idea that I'm helping adults rediscover dreaming, and that, you know, dreaming kind of gets a bad rap, especially when you get older, right? Oh, he's a dreamer. You know, it's very dismissive. But dreamers are able to see things that don't yet exist. You know, their mind can disengage from reality. And, you know, if you get too much reality, yeah, you're going to say, yeah, that's not possible. It didn't work in the past. Other people have tried it. Doesn't make sense. And, you know, dreamers can leave all that stuff behind and let their dream take shape. And hey, do you know what? Maybe this is the time for that dream. You know, maybe you needed to find the right combination of people to help make that dream a reality. So, you know, I do encourage dreaming, not just at night, but during the day, you know, daydreaming. But see, daydreaming, again, it kind of has a bad connotation. It's like, oh, they're not paying attention. No, you're paying attention to your dreams. Mm-hmm. And that's a real skill to be able to see something emerge in your mind. And that's why meditation, I'm so happy that mindfulness has come into schools in a sort of a sanctioned way in a lot of places, because mindfulness and meditation really is a way for us to experience being able to have one foot in reality and one foot in the dream world.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Steve Jobs was, you know, he was a fan of meditation, and I had heard that many of his innovations came from being in that in-between state. He was a really smart, logical guy, but he also was a dreamer, and he was able to take a peek into the future and see things that didn't yet exist, that no one else could see. And he was able to he was conscious enough to bring those dreams back, write them down, share them with his team. You know, I'm blessed because I'm a twin, and Paul and I, we often joke saying that, you know, there needed to be two of us to get everything done. and that, and often I would be tagged as the dreamer and Paul was the doer, right? So dream and do.
Yes.
And Paul would say, no, you dream it, I will make it happen. And as it turns out, over the years, I say, hey, Paul, do you know what? You're an amazing dreamer yourself and creative. It's time for you to start, you know, creating as well. So he wrote a book called Going Places. And he also wrote a series called Sydney and Simon about twin, fraternal twin mice who love science, engineering, technology, math. And of course, they're both artists and they think creatively. So I kind of flipped the table on Paul and said, all right, it's your turn to dream. And I ended up illustrating the books for him. So
it's actually one of my favorite books that you've written. It is such a beautiful book because it really talks about overcoming that pressure to conform to what the world wants you to be. And just for those who haven't read it, it's a kit. It's a do-it-yourself, make-your-own go-kart kit that the teacher hands out to every single one of the students. And the main character within it dreams up something different by looking at the world around her and interpreting that in such a way that it was a very different approach. And it wound up being something beautiful that no one else could have imagined. And so I just think it's such a beautiful book. And when I talked about this with my classes, what comes out is this really tangible understanding that we don't all have to be the same. Learning does not look the same. And imagination isn't always really easy to see how one connects the dots, if that makes sense. So initially it might look like daydreaming, it might look like quote unquote wasting time, but within that mind of the creative person, there's a whole lot of dots connecting, and what comes out of that is so beautiful. So I love that book, and I know a lot of educators love it as well. And
thank you.
Yeah, and how do you hope this book would inspire kids and adults to go from that dreaming stage to actually taking action and standing behind that dream and courageously making it real?
Having the patience, I think we're in short supply of these days, to just wait a little bit and see where, you know, see where it takes you. And, you know, right, as Vashti's teacher said in the dot, right, make a mark and see where it takes you. Mm-hmm. It may take a while, but, you know, just be patient. Let it kind of unfold. Don't be quick to judgment. Seeing a little girl who's daydreaming instead of doing her, working on her go-kart kit, if you're patient and you say, hey, wait a sec, look at that. She's sketching, you know, birds. What she was doing was she was exploring the idea of going places, the idea of getting from point A to point B, and there are lots of ways to do that. So she was actually doing a deep dive. It may have looked like she was not on task, not focused, but she was actually absolutely focused on the big idea, which, you know, Paul and I both are huge supporters of getting kids to think of the big idea, the essence, rather than the details. I think our education process is very much about the details, and we kind of forget, like, well, what's the essence? Like in the word collector, I took on vocabulary. You know, I had to memorize words every week. I memorized the definitions, you know, and I got my, you know, yellow star or whatever it was on my quizzes. But the words are just the details, right? The essence is the joy of communicating, the joy of words, the power of words, what they can do for us. I hope that we can, you know, all get more creative in education. I mean, United States is, we're very proud of being innovators and thinking outside of the box. We've got Silicon Valley, we have Hollywood, we have all of this creativity. We need to allow more of that into schools. And, you know, we have to stop, you know, what I call rinse and repeat. You know, hey, well, it worked last year, and, you know, we could change it by 3%. It's like, eh, do you know what? I think we need to give teachers permission to invent and reshape and trust them that they love their kids. You know, they want the best for their kids. And you want those kids to walk out of the door at the end of the year saying, that was the best year I ever had, and that was my favorite teacher. And hopefully that happens 12 times.
Yes.
And if we support teachers more and allow schools and districts to be, to actually bake innovation in and say, yeah, no, we want to innovate. Which, by the way, one of my ideas is theater program. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of schools don't have them, but, and they should, but I think theater should be taught in every single classroom, every single year. It should be, you should be able to connect the dots between science and theater. Yeah. Imagine, right, kids actually role-playing Einstein, creating a soliloquy by Isaac Newton, you know, set it to music, create your own Hamilton. And I do think that the art theater, especially getting kids to be comfortable on stage, which, by the way, is the number one fear from what I did a little research on fears. And of course, there's spiders and heights, but on the top of the list is public speaking.
Yes.
There's a lot of room for innovation in helping kids and grown-up kids to be more comfortable, and not just being on stage and acting, but by getting up there and sharing their voice and being proud of it, which sort of gets back to everything I do is to make you feel more comfortable with your voice, to be proud of your voice, and to have the confidence to share it, because, you know, the world does need your voice. It needs everyone's voices. There are a lot of very loud, boomy voices out there right now. And I think a lot of more nuanced, poetic voices are not being heard. Marginalized voices are not being heard. And that's actually the theme of the sequel to The Word Collector that's coming out in 2019. I'm very excited about this book because it picks up where The Word Collector leaves off, which Word Collector is find your words, love them, collect them. And then the new book is called Say Something. Now that you've got your words, what are you going to do with them? How are you going to tell the world what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you're dreaming? And that there are many, many ways to say something. Some people are really good at interviewing and doing podcasts. Some people are really good at jumping up on stage. Some people can grab the bullhorn. But there are some people who feel more comfortable speaking through their art, speaking through their music. Or just by showing up, you know, if there's a rally that you believe in, show up and don't say, do you know what, someone else is going to show up for me. We need you. We need everybody. So anyway, I'm very, very excited about that. And I hope your readers get a chance to read that book. And I hope it inspires them to say something and to change the world, make it a better place.
I think it's such a timely book, I think, because of all of this political and also social change that's happening right now, cultural change. I think you finished your book, The Word Collector, which again was a just gorgeous book and so inspiring. And I love, I think, what the backstory is to that, where you had a teacher who sort of looked at a story that you wrote in grade four, I believe, and and talked about your use of extraordinary words. And I would imagine that that's part of where that inspiration came from. But that last page where you said, reach for your own words, tell the world who you are and how you will make it better. And I just think that's such a beautiful message. And And I just, I think about this idea of purpose, and I think sometimes we get really wrapped up in finding our passion and our purpose, and it can be a very difficult, nebulous thing to pin down. And so when we talk about that, I look at your book, North Star. Just about everyone follows a path, and sometimes we're very conscious of that path and where we're headed to and what we hope to accomplish on that path. Sometimes we deviate from that path. What made you want to write that book? And how would you say that a child or an adult could tap into their own purpose or their passion in order to serve the world, in order to say something with those beautiful words that make a big difference for the world?
Yeah, well, the North Star was my first book. And I actually self-published that one. The original edition is self-published. And I think you can still find it in certain sites, still have it. It got republished by Canonwick Press several years later. But I felt pretty passionate about this story because I noticed that there are a lot of kids getting left behind in our system. And even the kids who did well, I don't know how well they were served, because as I was saying earlier, one of the questions we kind of forget to ask in our rush to get everyone through all the curriculum and pass all the tests and on their way to get their diploma, which is, that's a wonderful thing, but we really don't slow down and say, who are you? Mm-hmm. And these four questions came to my mind, which is, where have you been? Where are you now? Where are you going? And then probably the most powerful question, the North Star question, is where would you like to be going? Mm-hmm. Right. So that might actually be quite different than where you're going, or it could be even just a degree different. And if you are a sailor, you know that if you change course by one degree, you wait long enough, you're going to be in a very, very different place, months, years down the line. I wanted to introduce some way of getting conversation started about who are you, and have kids take ownership of their own compass, not always relying on the teacher or the school to say, okay, this is what you're reading, this is what you're being tested on, this is where you'll be, this is where you'll sit. A lot of stuff is done for us, and we don't have a lot of opportunity to sculpt our own path. Of course, the big surprise is at the end of your 12 years or 16 years, if you go to college, people stop telling you where to be and what to think and what to read. It's going to be up to you. And we don't give kids enough practice at thinking for themselves. And that's a huge theme for me. I love the idea of free will and thinking for yourself, using your own brain to form your own thoughts, your own beliefs, and to chart your own course.
Yes.
Right. And there are a lot of, and not just kids, but there are a lot of grownups out there too, who they kind of look around. They're like, how did I get here? This was not what I had imagined. Or they'll be like, I don't know what I imagined, but this doesn't feel right. Sitting in a cubicle or pick any career. It could even be something that you're really good at doing. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't bring you joy, I think you've missed the point. Because, the journey should be filled with as much joy as we can pack in. And we do have control over that. Mm-hmm. We have control of who we surround ourselves with, what we inspire ourselves with, what we create. It's also a reflection that our society has been through quite a few decades of, drive-through, instant quick downloads, listening to other people. I would love us to get back to, handcrafting our own journey, making our own dinners, putting, families together, getting friends together, surround yourself by kind people and kindred spirits. That's one of our favorite phrases, kindred spirits. Paul and I often talk about, finding the people who share your values, your beliefs, your dreams. And we're kind of romantic about that. We think that the world can be a better place if we just slow down, and take time to be creative.
I really like that idea of handcrafting your own journey. What a beautiful phrase, because I think that's true. Sometimes you're almost on autopilot, or it's very, very easy to be on autopilot, and even years can go by before you really take inventory of your own life. And I love those four guiding questions. So I will definitely be putting those in the show notes, because those are real heavy hitting questions, not only for children, but definitely for adults. So I appreciate that, because I think sometimes we need a little guidance to reframe where we're at. Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about your art teacher. I believe his name was Doug Cornfield, who gave you some of the best advice and fundamentally changed the way that you approach the art that you make. Can you talk a little bit about how he guided you to think about who it's for?
Sure. Yeah. Doug Cornfield was, and he still is, he's an amazing artist. He does a lot of public art, and he was teaching at the Cambridge Adult Ed Center in Harvard Square, which was one block away from Tom Snyder Productions, which is where I got my first job. And so I would take courses at the Cambridge Adult Ed Center, and I took some anatomy courses and drawing courses. Then I discovered Doug, and he had a class called Drawing with the Figure. So we had, there was a model, and we would be sketching away, and he would ask me just short, simple questions that kind of blew my mind. And one of them was, he asked me, he said, "Who are you drawing this for?" And I thought, well, I don't, you know, that's a good, nobody had asked me that quite before. And I think he probably looked at my puzzled face, and he said, do you bring your art home? Do you show anyone? I'm like, yeah, show it to, you know, family and friends. And he's like, oh, do they like it? And I'm like, well, you know, they, some they do and some, and he left me, and then he sort of came back and he said, do you know what? I would love it if you would just try this once. How about this next drawing you draw for yourself? And I had not even thought of that, drawing for myself. I mean, I think I probably had been doing that as I was doodling through life. But I think as you start growing up, you start trying to make things more practical. And what was happening with my art was I was trying to please other people. Mm. You know, certainly if you're a commercial artist and you're trying to make your client happy, yeah, you have to do that. But, you know, when you're in a drawing class, when you've got a big blank sheet of paper and you can do really whatever you want, there were no points off. You didn't get graded in this class. He just wanted you to make marks. And later on, he pointed out, he said, by the way, why are you drawing the model? I said, because it's called Drawing with the Figure. He said, yeah, well, he said, I titled it Drawing with the Figure because he said they couldn't put the full title in. He said, Drawing with the Figure in the Room. He said, the model shows up, she gets her money, he gets his money. I never told you had to draw the figure. I just wanted you to draw. The figure, you know, they're there, they're going to get their money. What do you want to draw? And I thought that was so amazing, because I'm thinking, well, I was just sort of, you know, I was kind of on autopilot.
Sure.
I went to the art class, there was an easel, there was a model in front of me, I draw the model. And he was really, really poking at me to say, what do you want to draw? What do you want to say? If you can say it for yourself and not for other people, you're going to discover some cool stuff, which is what happened. And there were lots of other things that he shared along the way. And I really wanted to thank him for helping me see not only art in a new way, but helping me see myself in a new way. And so I got to say thank you to him and dedicated the book-ish to Doug. And I took him out to lunch in Harvard Square. And I pulled the book out. And when he read the dedication, tears streamed down his face. It was really nice. It was wonderful to be able to say thank you to a mentor.
Wow. What a beautiful story. I didn't know the entire backstory. That's incredible. And what a gift to have given him in return, because as I'm sure you know, so many people are touched by your work, and I can only imagine what that feels like to receive that positive feedback and to see how it's touched people's lives. And I think about teachers like Terry Shea, who actually started this, the Dot Day, right? And I initially thought that it was something that you and your publisher would have started, but it actually came organically out of a teacher's passion for your books, and it's become this worldwide phenomenon.
Right? Yeah, it's amazing. In general, it's amazing what all teachers are doing, not only with my books, but with books. I mean, books are lovely. We want kids to read, but you know, you can read a book, close it, pick up another book, and move on, or you can hang out with a book and do a deep dive. You know, great teachers, they'll read a book and they'll say, oh my gosh, I know exactly what I'm going to do with this on Monday. And suddenly ideas start, you know, percolating and the popcorn pops. And we authors and illustrators are always delighted and amazed what educators can do to activate a book. And that story activation is really the magic. And Terry Shea, yeah, amazing teacher. We connected the dots because of my books and we became friends. And you know, we were talking about the importance of creativity, and you know, he was lamenting that there wasn't more creativity in schools. We were really thinking, you know, how could we make that happen? He was saying, wouldn't it be great if there was a day to celebrate that? Just sort of organically, this idea of International Dot Day sprung out. And initially, it was just he decided to do it in his classroom. And of course, his teacher friends saw what he was doing, and they said, "Can we join?" And then thousands joined, and then millions. And I think this year we were up to 13 plus million.
Wow! Wow!
Educators and kids and communities as well, all making their mark, making their dots, building frames, creating galleries, creating community galleries, doing 3D dots, augmented reality dots, in 180 countries.
Wow.
Which is kind of cool too, because, you know, we are finding the creative kindred spirits out there, and there is an amazing network of great people. There's just so much creativity that is happening, even despite some of the restraints in public education, especially. And I think it's encouraging for teachers to realize like, hey, you know, I'm not alone. There are a lot of really wildly creative people out there, and you're going to get inspired finding them. I mean, it's great when they're right across the hall, but hey, if they're in Japan or Belgium and they inspire you, then they're your creative neighbor. And I hope that we do lots more dot connecting and stirring things up and keeping the grid lit up with all this good energy.
So when it comes to your ideas, I heard on a recent interview that you have a journal with stories that are, quote, not yet in print. Yes. And that you have something like 400 or more stories in there. Mm-hmm. And you actually start with the title, which is so interesting, is sort of what I've heard. So when do these ideas come to you? And what are some of the common ways that you get inspired?
Yeah, I've got loads of ideas. And I mean, as time has marched on, I get more and more ideas. You know, I remember when I was very, you know, a young writer and I was, you know, sitting there trying to come up with an idea. That does not happen anywhere. My brain is just going the whole time and I'm getting ideas with every conversation I have. You know, I'll have a conversation and we'll be discussing something. I'm like, oh, you know, a story would be a great way to continue this conversation. And as I say, do the deeper dive. So I'm jotting ideas down all the time on scraps of paper in my journals. I think too that, I mean, two questions I like to ask is, what does the world need less of? Mm-hmm. And what does the world need more of? That's where a lot of my inspiration comes from, you know, thinking, okay, how can I help with both of those, right? The world needs a lot less hate, and the world needs a lot more understanding. Well, that's fertile ground for a story. And the lovely thing about a story is that you can model people who are experiencing that and have managed to untie the little knot in the story. And I think it's encouraging when you see, it's like, okay, I see what it looks like, and I see how this particular teacher or this child or this character untied the knot. Mm-hmm. And so I have I have lots more to say still. Yes. And of course, I've done the math. I don't like doing the math, but I do the math every so often to think, how many stories am I going to be able to share with the world? My mom is 90. She's in her 94th year, as she likes to say. Hmm. And so I'm hoping I've share some of her DNA, because I am not going to have enough time to write all the stories I want. Which, you know, when I talk to kids and grown-up kids too, say, do you know what? I can only do so much. There are lots more stories to tell. Can you please help? Mm. Can you help tell those stories that need to be heard? Can you capture your wisdom, you know, and share it? I think that picture books are incredibly powerful, because it makes the mission transportable. Mm. And in a quick 5 to 6 minutes, you can share a pretty powerful idea. So, and I think we all have stories to tell. So I encourage, you know, everyone that's listening, to tell your story, and maybe a picture book, could be a song, or it could just be a marvelous story around the dinner table.
Thank you for that really important message. I think everybody needs to hear it. As promised, we are on to the rapid fire, which I promise you are just a few minutes, because I'd like, if possible, for you to conform your answers to just a few words. So here they are. There are three of them. So the first one is, what does kindness mean to you?
Kindness to me is generosity, being open to new ideas, and the willingness to hang out with other people's ideas and not jump to conclusions. Mm. And to be accepting.
Mm. What is the most important superpower or skill that an educator needs to lead with in order to be effective?
I would say joy. Mm-hmm. Joy is a superpower. Kids can smell boredom a mile away. And if you are not bored with what you're talking about, and you let your joy shine through, kids are going to see it and they love it. They're like little plants. They need your joy.
I love that too. And finally, what quote would you print on one of those quote cups that would be sold in bookstores around the world?
Do you know what? One of my favorite quotes is by John Quincy Adams, who is the son of John Adams, both presidents. The quote is, patience and perseverance have a magical effect before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish. Mm-hmm. I just love that idea. And again, it takes kindness and generosity to let things unfold organically and not be in such a rush. We can solve these problems by hanging in there, being persistent and being supportive.
Wow. Peter Reynolds, this has been an absolute delight. I am so appreciative for your time and to have had the gift of speaking to you. I feel inspired and excited, and I know that my listeners will feel the same.
Wonderful. Well, I'm real honored to be with you, spend this time sipping tea here in my studio. And it's lovely to be connected not only to you, but to your audience. And I hope everyone has an amazing, inspirational, stellar journey.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.